It's October 1st, and here I am peeling peaches. Mr. Johnny's mama brought back two crates from Mexico, heavy as baseballs. They are ripe and sweet, like cutting through butter. I don't take charity from white ladies because I know they just want me to owe them. But when Miss Celia told me to take a dozen peaches home, I pulled out a sack and plopped 12 right in. When I get home tonight, I'm eating fried okra for supper and peach cobbler for dessert. I'm watching the long, fuzzy peel fold down into Miss Celia's basin, paying no mind at all to the driveway. Usually when I'm standing at her kitchen sink, I map out my getaway from Mr. Johnny. The kitchen's the best room for it because the front window looks out to the street. Tall azalea bushes hide my face, but I can see through enough to spot an approacher. If he came in the front door, the back door would escape me into the garage. If he came in the back, I could slip out through the front. Another door in the kitchen leads out to the backyard just in case. But what with the juice running down my hand and me near about drunk on the butter smell, I am lost in a peach-peeling reverie. I don't even notice the blue truck pull in. The man's made it halfway up the walk by the time I look up. I catch a sliver of white shirt, the variety of which I'm used to ironing every day, and the leg of a pair of khaki pants like I hang up at Mr. Johnny's closet. I choke on a yelp. My knife clatters in the sink. Miss Celia! I dash into her bedroom. Mr. Johnny's home! Miss Celia jumps out of her bed faster than I've ever seen her move before. I turn around in an idiot circle. Where am I going? Which way do I go? What happened to my getaway plan? And then I snap into decision. The guest bathroom. I slip in and keep the door cracked. I crouch up on the toilet seat so he can't see my feet under the door. It's dark in here and hot. I feel like my head's on fire. Sweat drips off my chin and splats on the floor. I feel sick by the thick smell of gardenia soaps by the sink. I hear footsteps. I hold my breath. The footsteps stop. My heart is thumping like a cat in a clothes dryer. What if Miss Celia pretends she doesn't know me so she won't get in trouble? Acts like I'm a burglar? Oh, I hate her. I hate that stupid woman. I listen, but all I can hear is my own panting, the thud-thud in my chest. My ankles hurt and creak holding up my body like this. My eyes grow sharper in the dark. After a minute, I see myself in the mirror over the sink, crouched like a fool on top of a white lady's toilet. Look at me. Look what it's come to for Minnie Jackson to make a damn living.
Miss Skeeter, Chapter 5. I drive my mama's Cadillac fast on the gravel road, headed home. Patsy Cline can't even be heard on the radio anymore, for all the rocks banging the side of the car. Mother would be furious, but I just drive faster. I can't stop thinking about what Hilly said to me today at Bridge Club. Hilly and Elizabeth and I have been best friends since Power Elementary. My favorite photograph is of the three of us sitting in the football stands in junior high, all jammed together, shoulder to shoulder. What makes the picture, though, is that the stands are completely empty around us. We sat close, because we were close. At Ole Miss, Hilly and I roomed together for 2 years before she left to get married and I stayed on to graduate. I rolled 13 curlers in her hair every night at the Chi Omega house. But today, she threatened to throw me out of the league. Not that I care so much about the league, but I was hurt by how easily my friend would be willing to cast me aside. I turn up the lane that leads to Longleaf, my family's cotton plantation. The gravel quiets to smooth yellow dust, and I slow down before Mother sees how fast I'm driving. I pull up to the house and get out. Mother is rocking on the front porch.
"Come, sit, darling,"
she says, waving me toward a rocking chair beside her.
"Pascagoula's just waxed the floors. Let them dry a while."
"All right, Mama." I kiss her powdery cheek, but I don't sit. I lean on the porch railing, look out on the three mossy oak trees in the front yard. Even though it's only 5 minutes outside of town, most people consider this the country out here. Surrounding our yard lie 10,000 acres of Daddy's cotton fields, The plants green and strong, tall as my waist. A few colored men sit under a distant shed, staring into the heat. Everyone is waiting for the same thing, for the cotton bowls to open. I think about how things are different between Hilly and me since I came home from school. But who is the different person? Her or me?
"Did I tell you?" Mother says. "Fanny Petro got engaged."
Good for Fanny.
Not even a month after she got that teller job at the Farmers Bank.
"That's great, Mother."
"I know," she says,
and I turn to see one of those light bulb popping looks of hers.
"Why don't you go down to the bank and apply for a teller job?"
"I don't want to be a bank teller, Mama." Mother sighs, narrows her eyes at the spaniel, Shelby, licking his nether parts. I eye the front door, tempted to ruin the clean floors anyway. We've had this conversation so many times.
"4 years my daughter goes off to college. And what does she come home with?"
she asks. "A diploma?"
"A pretty piece of paper,"
Mother says.
"I told you, I didn't meet anybody I wanted to marry,"
I say. Mother rises from her chair, comes close so I look in her smooth, pretty face. She's wearing a navy blue dress, narrow along her slim bones. As usual, her lipstick is just so. But when she steps into the bright afternoon sun, I see dark stains, deep and dried, on the front of her clothes. I squint my eyes trying to see if the stains are really there. "Mama, are you feeling bad?"
"If you just show a little gumption, Eugenia."
"Your dress is all dirty on the front." Mother crosses her arms.
"Now, I talked to Fanny's mother, and she said Fanny was practically swimming in opportunities once she got that job."
I drop the dress issue. I'll never be able to tell Mother I want to be a writer. She'll only turn it into yet another thing that separates me from the married girls. Nor can I tell her about Charles Gray, my math study partner last spring at Ole Miss, how he'd gotten drunk senior year and kissed me, and then squeezed my hand so hard it should have hurt, but it didn't. It felt wonderful, the way he was holding me and looking into my eyes. And then he married 5-foot Jenny Sprigg. What I needed to do was find an apartment in town, the kind of building where single, plain girls lived, spinsters, secretaries, teachers. But the one time I had mentioned using money from my trust fund, Mother had cried, real tears.
"That is not what that money's for, Eugenia. To live in some rooming house with strange cooking smells and stockings hanging out the window. And when the money runs out, what then? What will you live on?"
Then she had draped a cold cloth on her head and gone to bed for the day. And now she's gripping the rail, waiting to see if I'll do what Fat Fanny Petro did to save herself. My own mother is looking at me as if I completely baffle her mind with my looks, my height, my hair. To say I have frizzy hair is an understatement. It's kinky, more pubic than cranial, and whitish blonde, breaking off easily like hay. My skin is fair, and while some call this creamy, it can look downright deathly when I'm serious, which is all the time. Also, there's a slight bump of cartilage along the top of my nose. But my eyes are cornflower blue, like Mother's. I'm told that's my best feature.
"It's all about putting yourself in a man-meeting situation where you can..."
"Mama," I say, just wanting to end this conversation, "would it really be so terrible if I never met a husband?" Mother clutches her bare arms as if made cold by the thought.
Don't! Don't say that, Eugenia! Why, every week I see another man in town over 6 feet, and I think, if Eugenia would just try!
She presses her hand to her stomach, the very thought advancing her ulcers. I slip off my flats and walk down the front porch steps, while Mother calls out for me to put my shoes back on, threatening ringworm, mosquito encephalitis, the inevitability of death by no shoes, death by no husband. I shudder with the same left-behind feeling I've had since I graduated from college 3 months ago. I've been dropped off in a place I do not belong anymore. Certainly not here with Mother and Daddy. Maybe not even with Hilly and Elizabeth.
Here you are, 23 years old, and I'd already had Carlton Jr. at your age, Mother says.
I stand under the pink crepe myrtle tree, watching Mother on the porch. The daylilies have lost their blooms. It is nearly September.
I was not a cute baby. When I was born, my older brother, Carlton, looked at me and declared to the hospital room, "It's not a baby, it's a skeeter." And from there, the name stuck. I was long and leggy and mosquito thin, a record-breaking 25 inches at Baptist Hospital. The name grew even more accurate with my pointy, beak-like nose when I was a child. Mother's spent my entire life trying to convince people to call me by my given name, Eugenia. Mrs. Charlotte Boudreaux Cantrell Phelan does not like nicknames. By 16, I wasn't just not pretty. I was painfully tall. The kind of tall that puts a girl in the back row of class pictures with the boys. The kind of tall where your mother spends her nights taking down hems, yanking at sweater sleeves, flattening your hair for dances you hadn't been asked to, finally pressing the top of your head as if she could shrink you back to the years when she had to remind you to stand up straight. By the time I was 17, Mother would rather I suffered from apoplectic diarrhea than stand up straight. She was 5'4" and first runner-up at Miss South Carolina. She decided there was only one thing to do in a case like mine. Mrs. Charlotte Phelan's Guide to Husband Hunting. Rule number 1. A pretty petite girl should accentuate with makeup and good posture. A tall, plain one with a trust fund. I was 5'11", but I had $25,000 cotton dollars in my name, and if the beauty in that was not apparent, then by God, he wasn't smart enough to be in the family anyway. My childhood bedroom is the top floor of my parents' house. It has white frosting chair rails and pink cherubs in the molding. It's papered in mint green rosebuds. It is actually the attic, with long, sloping walls, and I cannot stand straight in many places. The box bay window makes the room look round. After Mother berates me about finding a husband every other day, I have to sleep in a wedding cake. And yet, it is my sanctuary. The heat swells and gathers like a hot air balloon up here, not exactly welcoming others. The stairs are narrow and difficult for parents to climb. Our previous maid, Constantine, used to stare those forward-sloping stairs down every day, like it was a battle between them. That was the only part I didn't like about having the top floor of the house, that it separated me from my Constantine. 3 days after my conversation with Mother on the porch, I spread out the Help Wanted ads from the Jackson Journal on my desk. All morning, Mother's been following me around with a new hair straightening thing,
while Daddy's been on the front porch growling and goddamning the cotton fields because they're melting like summer snow. Besides boll weevils, rain is just about the worst thing that can happen at harvest time. It's hardly September, but the fall drenches have already begun. My red pen in hand, I scan the squat single column under Help Wanted, Female. Kennington's Department Store seeks sales girls with poise, manners, and a smile. Trim young secretary wanted. Typing not necessary. Call Mr. Sanders. Jesus, if he doesn't want her to type, what does he want her to do? Junior stenographer wanted. Percy and Gray, LP. $1.25 per hour. This is new. I draw a circle around it. No one could argue that I hadn't worked hard at Ole Miss. While my friends were out drinking rum and cokes at Phi Delta Theta parties and pinning on mum corsages, I sat in the study parlor and wrote, for hours, mostly term papers, but also short stories, bad poetry, episodes of Dr. Kildare, Paul Mall jingles, letters of complaint, ransom notes, love letters to boys I'd seen in class but hadn't had the nerve to speak to, all of which I never mailed. Sure, I dreamed of having football dates, but my real dream was that one day I would write something that people would actually read. Fourth term of my senior year, I only applied to one job, but it was a good one, being 600 miles away from Mississippi. Piling 22 dimes in the Oxford Mart payphone, I'd inquired about an editor position at the Harper & Row Publishing House on 33rd Street in Manhattan. I'd seen the ad in the New York Times, down at the Ole Miss Library, and mailed them my resume that very day. On a sprig of hope, I even called about an apartment listing on East 85th Street, a one-bedroom with hot plate for $45 a month. Delta Airlines told me a one-way ticket to Idlewild Airport would cost $73. I didn't have the sense to apply for more than one job at a time, and I never even heard back from them. My eyes drift down to Help Wanted Mail. There are at least four columns filled with bank managers, accountants, loan officers, cotton collate operators. On this side of the page, Percy and Gray, LP, is offering junior stenographers 50 cents more an hour.
Mosquito, you got a phone call?
I hear Pascagoula holler at the bottom of the stairs. I go downstairs to the only phone in the house. Pascagoula holds the phone out to me. She is as tiny as a child, not even 5 feet tall, and black as night. Her hair is curly around her head, and her white uniform dress has been tailored to fit her short arms and legs.
Miss Hilly on the phone for you,
she says, and hands it to me with a wet hand. I sit at the white iron table. The kitchen is large and square and hot. Black and white linoleum tiles are cracked in places, worn thin in front of the sink. The new silver dishwashing machine sits in the middle of the room, attached to a hose stretched from the faucet.
He's coming next weekend, Hilly says. On Saturday night. You free?
Gee, let me check my calendar, I say. All traces of our bridge club argument are gone from Hilly's voice. I'm suspicious, but relieved.
I can't believe this is finally going to happen,
Hilly says, because she's been trying to set me up for months with her husband's cousin. She's intent on it, even though he's much too good-looking for me, not to mention a state senator's son. Don't you think we should meet first? I ask. I mean, before we go out on an actual date.
Don't be nervous. William and I will be right next to you the whole time.
I sigh. The date's been canceled twice already. I can only hope it'll be put off again. And yet I'm flattered that Hilly has so much faith that someone like him would be interested in someone like me.
Oh, and I need you to come on by and pick up these notes, Hilly says. I want my initiative in the next newsletter. A full page next to the photo ops.
I pause. The bathroom thing? Even though it was only a few days ago that she'd brought this up at Bridge Club, I'd hoped it was forgotten.
It's called the Home Help Sanitation Initiative. William Jr., you get down or I will snatch you bald-headed. You may get in here. And I want it in this week.
I am editor of the League newsletter, but Hilly is president, and she's trying to tell me what to print. I'll see. I don't know if there's room. I lie. From the sink, Pascagoula sneaks a look at me, as if she can hear what Hilly's saying. I look over at Constantine's bathroom, now Pascagoula's. It's off the kitchen. The door's half open, and I can see a tiny room with a toilet, a pull-string flusher at the top, a bulb with a yellowing plastic shade. The small corner sink hardly holds a glass of water. I've never once been inside. When we were kids, Mother told us she'd spank us if we went in Constantine's bathroom. I miss Constantine more than anything I've ever missed in my life.
Then make room, Hilly says, because this is pretty darn important.
Constantine lived about a mile from our house, in a small Negro neighborhood called Hot Stack, named after the tar plant that used to operate back there. The road to Hot Stack runs along the north side of our farm, and for as long as I can remember, colored kids have walked and played along that mile stretch, kicking at the red dust, making their way toward the big county road 49 to catch a ride. I used to walk that hot mile myself when I was a girl. If I begged and practiced my catechism, Mother would sometimes let me go home with Constantine on Friday afternoons. After 20 minutes of walking slow, we'd pass the colored five and dime store, then a grocer with hens laying in back, and all along the way, dozens of shacky-looking roadside houses with tin roofs and slanting porches, along with a yellow one that everybody said sold whiskey from the back door. It was a thrill to be in such a different world, and I'd feel a prickly awareness of how good my shoes were, how clean my white pinafore dress that Constantine had ironed for me. The closer we got to Constantine's house, the more she'd smile.
"Hi, do, Carbird,"
Constantine'd holler at the root-selling man sitting in his rocking chair on the back of his pickup. Bags of sassafras and licorice root and bird-eye vine sat open for bargaining, and by the time we poked around those a minute, Constantine's whole body'd be rambling and loose in the joints. Constantine wasn't just tall. She was stout. She was also wide in the hips, and her knees gave her trouble all the time. At the stump on her corner, she would stick a pinch of Happy Days snuff in her lip and spit juice straight as an arrow. She'd let me look at the black powder in its round tin, but say, "Don't tell your mama now." There were always dogs, hollow-stomached and mangy, laid out in the road. From a porch, a young colored woman named Catbite would holler,
"Miss Skeeter! Tell your daddy hey for me. Tell him I's doing fine."
My own daddy gave her that name years ago. Drove by and saw a rabid cat attacking a little colored girl.
"That cat near about ate her up,"
Daddy had told me afterward. He'd killed the cat, carried the girl to the doctor, and set her up for the 21 days of rabies shots. A little farther on, we'd get to Constantine's house. It had 3 rooms and no rugs, and I'd look at the single photograph she had, of a white girl she told me she looked after for 20 years over in Port Gibson. I was pretty sure I knew everything about Constantine. She had one sister and grew up on a sharecropping farm in Corinth, Mississippi. Both her parents were dead. She didn't eat pork, as a rule, and wore a size 16 dress and a size 10 lady's shoe. But I used to stare at the toothy smile of that child in the picture, a little jealous, wondering why she didn't have a picture of me up, too. Sometimes two girls from next door would come over to play with me, named Mary Nell and Mary Roan. They were so black I couldn't tell them apart and called them both just Mary. "Be nice to the little colored girls when you're down there," Mother said to me one time, and I remember looking at her funny, saying, "Why wouldn't I be?" But Mother never explained. After an hour or so, Daddy would pull up, get out, hand Constantine a dollar. Not once did Constantine invite him inside. Even back then, I understood we were on Constantine's turf, and she didn't have to be nice to anybody at her own house. Afterward, Daddy would let me go in the colored store for a cold drink and sucking candy. "Don't tell your mama I gave Constantine a little extra now." "Okay, Daddy," I'd say. That's about the only secret my daddy and I have ever shared. The first time I was ever called ugly, I was 13. It was a rich friend of my brother Carlton's, over to shoot guns in the field. "Why you crying, girl?" Constantine asked me in the kitchen. I told her what the boy had called me, tears streaming down my face.
"Well, is you?"
I blinked, paused my crying. "Is I what?"
"Now you look here, Eugenia."
Because Constantine was the only one who'd occasionally follow Mama's rule.
"Ugly live up on the inside. Ugly be a hurtful, mean person. Is you one of them peoples?"
"I don't know. I don't think so," I sobbed. Constantine sat down next to me at the kitchen table. I heard the cracking of her swollen joints. She pressed her thumb hard in the palm of my hand, something we both knew meant, "Listen. Listen to me.
Every morning, until you dead in the ground, you gonna have to make this decision."
Constantine was so close, I could see the blackness of her gums.
"You gonna have to ask yourself, am I gonna believe what them fools say about me today?"
She kept her thumb pressed hard in my hand. I nodded that I understood. I was just smart enough to realize she meant white people. And even though I still felt miserable and knew that I was most likely ugly, it was the first time she ever talked to me like I was something besides my mother's white child. All my life I'd been told what to believe about politics, coloreds, being a girl. But with Constantine's thumb pressed in my hand, I realized I actually had a choice in what I could believe. Constantine came to work in our house at 6 in the morning. And at harvest time, she came at 5. That way, she could fix Daddy his biscuits and gravy before he headed to the field. I woke up nearly every day to her standing in the kitchen, Preacher Green playing on the radio that sat on the kitchen table. The minute she saw me, she smiled.
"Good morning, beautiful girl."
I'd sit at the kitchen table and tell her what I'd dreamed. She claimed dreams told the future. "I was in the attic, looking down at the farm," I'd tell her. "I could see the tops of the trees."
"You gonna be a brain surgeon. Top of the house mean the head."
Mother ate her breakfast early in the dining room, then moved to the relaxing room to do needlepoint or write letters to missionaries in Africa. From her green wing chair, she could see everyone going almost anywhere in the house. It was shocking what she could process about my appearance in the split second it took for me to pass by that door. I used to dash by, feeling like a dartboard, a big red bullseye that Mother pinged darts at.
Eugenia, you know there is no chewing gum in this house. Eugenia, go put alcohol on that blemish. Eugenia, march upstairs and brush your hair down. What if we have an unexpected visitor?
I learned that socks are stealthier transportation than shoes. I learned to use the back door. I learned to wear hats, cover my face with my hands when I passed by. But mostly, I learned to just stay in the kitchen. A summer month could stretch on for years, out on Longleaf. I didn't have friends coming over every day. We lived too far out to have any white neighbors. In town, Hilly and Elizabeth spent all weekend going to and from each other's houses, while I was only allowed to spend the night out or have company every other weekend. I grumbled over this plenty. I took Constantine for granted at times, but I think I knew, for the most part, how lucky I was to have her there. When I was 14, I started smoking cigarettes. I'd sneak them from Carlton's packs of Marlboros he kept in his dresser drawer. He was almost 18, and no one minded that he'd been smoking for years, anywhere he wanted to in the house or out in the fields with Daddy. Sometimes Daddy smoked a pipe, but he wasn't a cigarette man, and Mother didn't smoke anything at all, even though most of her friends did. Mother told me I wasn't allowed to smoke until I was 17. So I'd slip into the backyard and sit in the tire swing, with the huge old oak tree concealing me. Or, late at night, I'd hang out of my bedroom window and smoke. Mother had eagle eyes, but she had almost zero sense of smell. Constantine knew immediately, though. She narrowed her eyes with a little smile, but said nothing. If Mother headed to the back porch while I was behind the tree, Constantine would rush out and bang her broom handle on the iron stair rail.
"Constantine, what are you doing?"
Mother would ask her, but by then I would have stubbed it out and dropped the butt in the hole in the tree.
"Just cleaning this here old broom, Miss Charlotte." "Well, find a way to do it a little quieter, please." "Oh, Eugenia, what? Did you grow another inch overnight? What am I going to do? Go, put on a dress that fits."
"Yes, ma'am," Constantine and I would say at the same time, and then pass each other a little smile. Oh, it was delicious to have someone to keep secrets with. If I'd had a sister or a brother closer in age, I guessed that's what it would be like. But it wasn't just smoking or skirting around Mother. It was having someone look at you after your mother has nearly fretted herself to death because you're freakishly tall and frizzy and odd. Someone whose eyes simply said, without words, "You are fine with me." Still, it wasn't all sweet talk with her. When I was 15, a new girl had pointed at me and asked, "Who's the stork?" Even Hilly had tucked back a smile before steering me away, like we hadn't heard her. "How tall are you, Constantine?" I asked, unable to hide my tears. Constantine narrowed her eyes at me.
"How tall is you?"
5'11", I cried. "I'm already taller than the boys' basketball coach."
"Well, I'm 5'13", so quit feeling sorry for yourself."
Constantine's the only woman I've ever had to look up to to look her straight in the eye. What you noticed first about Constantine, besides her tallness, were her eyes. They were light brown, strikingly honey-colored against her dark skin. I've never seen light brown eyes on a colored person. In fact, the shades of brown on Constantine were endless. Her elbows were absolutely black, with a dry white dust on them in the winter. The skin on her arms and neck and face was a dark ebony. The palms of her hands were orangey tan, and that made me wonder if the soles of her feet were too. But I never saw her barefooted.
"Jessie, you and me this weekend," she said with a smile.
It was the weekend that Mother and Daddy were driving Carlton to look at LSU and Tulane. My brother was going to college next year. That morning, Daddy had moved the cot into the kitchen, next to her bathroom. That's where Constantine always slept when she spent the night.
"Go, look what I got," she said, pointing to the broom closet.
I went and opened it and saw, tucked in her bag, a 500-piece puzzle with a picture of Mount Rushmore on it. It was our favorite thing to do when she stayed over. That night we sat for hours, munching on peanuts, sifting through the pieces spread out on the kitchen table. A storm raged outside, making the room cozy while we picked out the edges. The bulb in the kitchen dimmed, then brightened again.
"Which one he?"
Constantine asked, studying the puzzle box through her black-rimmed glasses.
"That's Jefferson."
"Oh, it sure is. What about him?"
"That's..." I leaned over. "I think that's Roosevelt."
"Only one I recognize is Lincoln. He looked like my daddy."
I stopped, puzzle piece in hand. I was 14 and had never made less than an A. I was smart, but I was as naive as they come. Constantine put the box top down and looked over the pieces again.
"Because your daddy was so tall?" I asked.
She chuckled.
"'Cause my daddy was white. I got the tall from my mama."
I put the piece down. "Your father was white and your mother was colored?"
"Yep,"
she said and smiled, snapping two pieces together.
"Well, look at that. Got me a match."
I had so many questions.
Who was he?
Where was he? I knew he wasn't married to Constantine's mother, because that was against the law. I picked a cigarette from my stash I'd brought to the table. I was 14, but feeling very grown up, I lit it. As I did, the overhead light dimmed to a dull, dirty brown, buzzing softly.
"Oh, my daddy loved me. Always said I was his favorite."
She leaned back in her chair.
"He used to come over to the house every Saturday afternoon. And one time, he gave me a set of 10 hair ribbons, 10 different colors. Brought them over from Paris, made out of Japanese silk. I sat in his lap from the minute he got there until he had to leave. And Mama'd play Bessie Smith on the Victrola he brung her, and he and me'd sing, 'It's mighty strange, without a doubt. Nobody knows you when you're down and out.'"
I listened, wide-eyed, stupid, glowing by her voice in the dim light. If chocolate was a sound, it would have been Constantine's voice singing. If singing was a color, it would have been the color of that chocolate.
"One time, I was a boo-hooing over hard feelings. I reckon I had a list of things to be upset about. Being poor, cold baths, rotten tooth, I don't know. But he held me by the head, hugged me to him for the longest time. When I looked up, he was crying too. And he did that thing I do to you, so you know I mean it. Press his thumb up in my hand, and he say, he's sorry.
We sat there, staring at the puzzle pieces. Mother wouldn't want me to know this, that Constantine's father was white, that he had apologized to her for the way things were. It was something I wasn't supposed to know. I felt like Constantine had given me a gift. I finished my cigarette, stubbed it out in the silver guest ashtray. The light brightened again. Constantine smiled at me and I smiled back. "How come you never told me this before?" I said, looking into her light brown eyes.
"I can't tell you every single thing, Skeeter."
"But why?" She knew everything about me, everything about my family. Why would I ever keep secrets from her? She stared at me and I saw a deep, bleak sadness there, inside of her. After a while, she said,
"Some things I've just got to keep for myself."
When it was my turn to go off to college, Mother cried her eyes out when Daddy and I pulled away in the truck. But I felt free. I was off the farm, out from under the criticism. I wanted to ask Mother, "Aren't you glad? Aren't you relieved that you don't have to worry ward over me every day anymore?" But Mother looked miserable. I was the happiest person in my freshman dorm. I wrote Constantine a letter once a week, telling her about my room, the classes, the sorority. I had to mail her letters to the farm since the post didn't deliver to Hot Stack, and I had to trust that Mother wouldn't open them. Twice a month, Constantine wrote me back on parchment paper that folded into an envelope. Her handwriting was large and lovely, although it ran at a crooked angle down the page. She wrote me every mundane detail of Longleaf. "My back pains are bad, but it's my feet that are worse." Or, "The mixer broke off from the bowl and flew wild around the kitchen, and the cat hollered and ran off. I haven't seen her since." She'd tell me that Daddy had a chest cold, or that Rosa Parks was coming to her church to speak. Often she demanded to know if I was happy, and the details of this. Our letters were like a year-long conversation, answering questions back and forth, continuing face-to-face at Christmas or between summer school sessions. Mother's letters said, "Say your prayers," and "Don't wear heels because they make you too tall," clipped to a check for $35. In April of my senior year, a letter came from Constantine that said, "I have a surprise for you, Skeeter. I am so excited I almost can't stand myself. And don't you go asking me about it, neither. You will see for yourself when you come home." That was close to final exams, with graduation only a month away. And that was the last letter I ever got from Constantine. I skipped my graduation ceremony at Ole Miss. All my close friends had dropped out to get married, and I didn't see the point in making Mama and Daddy drive 3 hours just to watch me walk across the stage, when what Mother really wanted was to watch me walk down the aisle. I still hadn't heard from Harper and Rowe, so instead of buying a plane ticket to New York, I rode home to Jackson in sophomore Kay Turner's Buick, squeezed in the front with my typewriter at my feet and her wedding dress between us. Kay Turner was marrying Percy Stanhope next month. For 3 hours, I listened to her worry about cake flavors. When I got home, Mother stepped back to get a better look at me. "Well, your skin looks beautiful," she said. "But your hair..." She sighed, shook her head. Where's Constantine? I asked. In the kitchen? And like she was delivering the weather, Mother said, Constantine is no longer employed here. Now, let's get all these trunks unpacked before you ruin your clothes. I turned and blinked at her. I didn't think I'd heard her correctly. What did you say? Mother stood straighter, smoothing down her dress. Constantine's gone, Skeeter. She went to live with her people up in Chicago. But what? She didn't say anything in her letters about Chicago. I knew that wasn't her surprise. She would have told me such terrible news immediately. Mother took a deep breath, straightened her back. I told Constantine she wasn't to write you about leaving, not in the middle of your final exams. What if you'd flunked and had to stay on another year? God knows, 4 years of college is more than enough. And she agreed to that? Not to write me and tell me she was leaving? Mother looked off, sighed. We'll discuss it later, Eugenia. Come on to the kitchen. Let me introduce you to the new maid, Pascagoula. But I didn't follow Mother to the kitchen. I stared down at my college trunks, terrified by the thought of unpacking here. The house felt vast, empty. Outside, a combine whirred in a cotton field. By September, not only had I given up hope of ever hearing back from Harper and Rowe, I gave up on ever finding Constantine. No one seemed to know a thing or how I could reach her. I finally stopped asking people why Constantine had left. It was like she'd simply disappeared. I had to accept that Constantine, my one true ally, had left me to fend for myself with these people. Chapter 6. On a hot September morning, I wake up in my childhood bed, slip on the huarache shoes my brother Carlton brought me back from Mexico. A man's pair, since, evidently, Mexican girls' feet don't grow to size 9.5. Mother hates them and says they're trashy looking. Over my nightgown, I put on one of Daddy's old button-down shirts and slip out the front door. Mother is on the back porch with Pascagoula and Jameso while they shuck oysters. You cannot leave a Negro and a Negra together unchaperoned, Mother had whispered to me a long time ago. It's not their fault. They just can't help it. I head down the steps to see if my mail-order copy of Catcher in the Rye is in the box. I always order the banned books from a black market dealer in California, figuring if the state of Mississippi banned them, they must be good. By the time I reach the end of the drive, my huaraches and ankles are covered with fine yellow dust. On either side of me, the cotton fields are a glaring green, fat with boles. Daddy lost the back fields to the rain last month, but the majority bloomed unharmed. The leaves are just starting to spot brown with defoliant, and I can still smell the sour chemical in the air. There are no cars on the county road. I open the mailbox. And there, underneath Mother's Ladies' Home Journal, is a letter addressed to Miss Eugenia Phelan. The red raised font in the corner says, Harper and Row, Publishers. I tear it open right there in the lane, in nothing but my long nightgown and Daddy's old Brooks Brothers shirt. September 4, 1962. Dear Miss Phelan, I am responding personally to your resume because I found it admirable that a young lady with absolutely no work experience would apply for an editing job at a publisher as prestigious as ours. A minimum of 5 years in the business is mandatory for such a job. You'd know this if you'd done any amount of research on the business. Having once been an ambitious young lady myself, however, I've decided to offer you some advice. Go to your local newspaper and get an entry-level job. You included in your letter that you immensely enjoy writing. When you're not making mimeographs or fixing your boss's coffee, look around, investigate, and write. Don't waste your time on the obvious things. Write about what disturbs you, particularly if it bothers no one else. Yours sincerely, Elaine Stein, Senior Editor, Adult Book Division. Below the pica type is a handwritten note in a choppy blue scrawl. P.S. If you are truly serious, I'd be willing to look over your best ideas and give my opinion. I offer this for no better reason, Miss Phelan, than someone once did it for me. A truck full of cotton rumbles by on the county road. The Negro in the passenger side leans out and stares. I've forgotten I am a white girl in a thin nightgown. I have just received correspondence, maybe even encouragement, from New York City. And I say the name aloud. Elaine Stein. I have never met a Jewish person. I race back up the lane, trying to keep the letter from flapping in my hand. I don't want it wrinkled. I dash up the stairs with Mother hollering to take off those tacky Mexican man shoes, and I get to work, writing down every goddamn thing that bothers me in life, particularly those that do not seem to faze anyone else. Elaine Stein's words are running hot silver through my veins, and I type as fast as I can. Turns out, it is a spectacularly long list. By the next day, I am ready to mail my first letter to Elaine Stein, listing the ideas I thought worthy journalism material. The prevalence of illiteracy in Mississippi, the high number of drunk driving accidents in our county, the limited job opportunities for women. It's not until after I mail the letter that I realize I probably chose those ideas she would think impressive, rather than ones I was really interested in. I take a deep breath and pull open the heavy glass door. A feminine little bell tinkles hello. A not-so-feminine receptionist watches me. She is enormous and looks uncomfortable in the small wooden chair.
Welcome to the Jackson Journal. Can I help you?
I had made my appointment day before yesterday, hardly an hour after I'd received Elaine Stein's letter. I asked for an interview for any position they might have. I was surprised they said they'd see me so soon.
I'm here to see Mr. Golden, please.
The receptionist waddles to the back in her tented dress. I try and calm my shaking hands. I peek through the open door to a small, wood-paneled room in the back. Inside, four men in suits bang away on typewriters and scratch with pencils. They're bent over, haggard, three with just a horseshoe of hair left. The room is gauzy with cigarette smoke. The receptionist reappears, thumbs me to follow her, cigarette dangling in her hand.
Come on back.
Despite my nerves, all I can think of is the old college rule. A Chi Omega never walks with a cigarette. I follow her through the desks of staring men, the haze of smoke, to an interior office.
Close that thing back,
Mr. Golden hollers as soon as I've opened the door and stepped in.
Don't let all that damn smoke in here.
Mr. Golden stands up behind his desk. He's about 6 inches shorter than me, trim, younger than my parents. He has long teeth and a sneer, the greased black hair of a mean man.
Didn't you hear?
He said.
They announced last week cigarettes will kill you.
I hadn't heard that. I can only hope it hadn't been on the front page of his newspaper.
Hell, I know niggers 100 years old look younger than those idiots out there.
He sits back down, but I keep standing because there are no other chairs in the room.
All right, let's see what you got.
I hand him my resume and sample articles I'd written in school. I grew up with the journal sitting on our kitchen table, open to the farm report or the local sports page. I rarely had time to read it myself. Mr. Golden doesn't just look at my papers. He edits them with a red pencil.
Maraha, editor, 3 years. Rebel Rouser, editor, 2 years. Chi Omega, editor, 3 years. Double major, English and journalism, graduated number 4. Damn, girl, he mutters. Didn't you have any fun?
I clear my throat. Is that important? He looks up at me.
You're peculiarly tall, but I think a pretty girl like you'd be dating the whole goddamn basketball team.
I stare at him, not sure if he's making fun of me or paying me a compliment.
I assume you know how to clean.
He looks back to my articles, strikes them with violent red marks. My face flushes hot and quick.
Clean? I'm not here to clean. I'm here to write.
Cigarette smoke is bleeding under the door. It's like the entire place is on fire. I feel so stupid that I thought I could just walk in and get a job as a journalist. He sighs heavily, hands me a thick folder of papers.
I guess you'll do. Miss Myrna's gone shithouse crazy on us. Drunk hairspray or something. Read the articles. Write the answers like she does. Nobody'll know the damn difference.
What? And I take the folder because I don't know what else to do. I have no idea who this Miss Myrna is. I ask the only safe question I can think of. How much did you say it pays? He gives me a surprisingly appreciative look, from my flat shoes to my flat hairstyle. Some dormant instinct tells me to smile, run my hand through my hair. I feel ridiculous, but I do it.
$8, every Monday.
I nod, trying to figure out how to ask him what the job is without giving myself away. He leans forward.
You do know who Miss Myrna is, don't you?
Of course. We girls read her all the time, I say. And again we stare at each other long enough for a distant telephone to ring 3 times.
What then? 8's not enough? Jesus, woman, go clean your husband's toilet for free.
I bite my lip, but before I can utter anything, he rolls his eyes.
All right, 10. Copies due on Thursdays, and if I don't like your style, I'm not printing it or paying you squat.
I take the folder. Thank him more than I probably should. He ignores me and picks up his phone and makes a call before I'm even out the door. When I get to my car, I sink down into the soft Cadillac leather. I sit there smiling, reading the pages in the folder. I just got a job. I come home standing up straighter than I have since I was 12, before my growth spurt. I am buzzing with pride. Even though every cell in my brain says do not, somehow I cannot resist telling Mother. I rush into the relaxing room and tell her everything about how I've gotten a job writing Miss Myrna, the weekly cleaning advice column.
Oh, the irony of it.
She lets out a sigh that means life is hardly worth living under such conditions. Pascagoula freshens her iced tea.
At least it's a start, I say. A start? At what? Giving advice on how to keep up a home when...
She sighs again, long and slow, like a deflating tire. I look away, wondering if everyone in town will be thinking the same thing. Already, the joy is fleeting.
Eugenia, you don't even know how to polish silver, much less advise on how to keep a house clean.
I hug the folder to my chest. She's right. I won't know how to answer any of the questions. Still, I thought she'd at least be proud of me.
And you will never meet anybody sitting at that typewriter.
Eugenia, have some sense.
Anger worked